From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There have been many books written and debates had about the role of digital technology in our lives and society. The discourse is often focused on whether our unprecedented connectedness is a blessing or a curse. Smartphones in particular, which are akin to mini internet-enabled computers, are now so ubiquitous they've become indispensable to us. A new book focusing on how smartphones have changed, or not changed, society and people explores this debate through a critical progressive lens. Its author is Nicole Ashoff, editor-at-large of Jacobin magazine, where she writes about capitalism, technology, and labor. Her first book was The New Profits of Capitalism. She now joins me to discuss her newest book, The Smartphone Society, Technology, Power, and Resistance in the New Gilded Age. Welcome to the program, Nicole.
Hi, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
So you focus on smartphones, not digital technology in general. Why smartphones in particular?
Well, in some sense, smartphones for me are kind of encapsulate the broader digital technology kind of wave that's crashing over society. And for me personally, I became interested in smartphones as I was teaching, and I was looking at my students, everyone glued to their phones, and it became a way for me to kind of connect with them, to discuss and describe modern trends in sociology through their smartphones. But as I talked more and more with my students, I became interested in smartphones as something much bigger, as a kind of window into modern society. And so, you know, for the past few years, I've been thinking about them. And I really do think that they are a marvelous way of understanding change in our society over the past decade.
So more people have smartphones than necessarily computers, right? Is that accurate?
Yes, absolutely. And particularly if we're thinking about the global scene.
Right. Yes. I mean, you see images or photographs even from, say, rural parts of India or the African subcontinent where there might be, perhaps television or computer or air conditioning, but there's a smartphone in someone's hand because, of course, this is a technology that is more accessible than some of these other more expensive technologies. And a single smartphone can do so many things. I mean, people have made a whole movies on them, like movies seen in theaters.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, smartphones are allowing people around the world to kind of leapfrog into the digital age. Although it is interesting, my husband's family is from Himachal Pradesh, and I think that they're actually more digitally connected than many parts of the United States, thanks to a huge effort to actually connect households in that region with broadband. So it's interesting, but certainly your point is absolutely true. Most people around the world connect to the internet through their smartphone, and it's really been an amazing kind of change in the past decade that billions of people now are connected to the web and to each other, which is, you know, for better or for worse, really changing, the world around us.
And so these are not just internet-enabled mini computers. Because they're mini, we take them with us everywhere, and they are extremely portable. One of the things that you write about in your book that makes them so powerful is, of course, the fact that people can document the abuses of power. In particular, they can document, here in the United States, instances of police brutality or incidents of other sort of racist attacks that they might be witnessing in a way that, you know, we didn't have before because people didn't walk around with camcorders, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, that is one example of how people repurpose technology in unexpected ways, and they integrate technology into their own political projects and their own way of life. So when we think about communities, certainly communities have been monitoring the police for many decades. But the introduction of the smartphone is a new way, and of course this is in the news this week, a new way of really visualizing and you know, highlighting the abuse that many people of color in poor communities around the United States experience every day. And it becomes visible to, you know, the broader public in a way that just wasn't possible before.
And have smartphones helped somewhat to bridge the digital divide, particularly when it comes to low-income communities and communities of color?
Well, in the most basic sense, people, about one in five or even one in four people in the United States, estimates vary, rely primarily on their smartphone or entirely on their smartphone for access to the web. This is better than having no access, but of course it's extremely limited. When we think about all of the things that we use our connection to the internet for, whether it's applying for a job, or filling out government paperwork, or, you know, accessing crucial information, certainly in this time, not
applying
all of those
things. Applying for unemployment benefits, perhaps.
Exactly. Applying for unemployment benefits. Those things can be difficult or impossible to do on a smartphone. So while it's great that people are able to have some connection, I think the reliance on our smartphones actually illustrates this kind of divide, particularly in this moment when we're stuck at home and trying to learn virtually, work virtually, those things you cannot do on a smartphone.
What is the downside of the smartphone technology? Because what you were just saying, you know, might be met with the response of, well, everyone, we should try to get everybody to having smartphones. That small percentage of people that still don't have access to this technology or to have one. But what is the downside of this? I mean, you mentioned your students are on their phones constantly, and, you know, at the superficial level, if you ride public transportation, which, okay, maybe these days you don't do as much, but when we would ride public transportation, rather than people looking around, possibly even talking to one another, mostly we're on our phones.
Yeah, I think the example of people looking at their phone when they're on the subway or the bus rather than chatting up a neighbor is valid, but often overstated. I am old enough to have lived in the pre-smartphone world, and when I wasn't carrying my phone around with me, I wasn't always sparking up conversation with strangers. I think social etiquette often prevented that sort of behavior. And also, you know, when we're on in these kind of spaces where we're transitioning from one place to another, we're bored, right? So we want to have a little entertainment, catch up with friends. I think that kind of behavior is fine. But we do need to be very cautious about our relationship with our smartphones, certainly in the sense of people who find themselves unable to be without their phone or looking at their phone, checking their phone constantly, you know, finding that it's a major interruption. But stepping back from these kind of critiques, which I think are valid and need to be examined further, I think that there's a bigger problem, which is one that I discuss in the book at length, which is this relationship with our phones that's revealing a very unequal kind of power dynamic between, you know, the average smartphone user and these big tech companies like Google and Facebook, who are really you know, controlling this, whether it's the social media architecture or the actual sort of software and hardware of our phone, and actually tracking us 24 hours a day, and really collecting vast amounts of data about users, and what I argue is a very unequal exchange.
Right. So we unwittingly carry with us little locators that and the data from that our phones send back to the companies that we contract with is so valuable that it's sold to third companies. And sometimes, you know, we can get some valuable information from that and it can be anonymized. For example, now people are, you know, you can have reports about whether certain trends can be observed. Are people observing social distancing guidelines during quarantines or not? But of course, the data is only as anonymous as the companies who control them wish it to be, right?
Absolutely. And I think the point that you raised about this question of surveillance and privacy in the present moment, as we're developing strategies to combat this terrible pandemic, really highlights the deep connection that we've developed with smartphones over the past decade. Certainly, when we look at strategies that both governments, in partnership with private companies, are developing, such as contact tracing and using anonymized location data from smartphones to create heat maps. These kinds of strategies hinge upon this already complex and persistent relationship that we have with our smartphones and other digital technologies. They're able to kind of piggyback these kind of norms and behaviors that we've already developed, which really both highlights certain kind of worrisome trends, the ability to track us in such a fine-grained way, and also really raises, you know, deep questions about, you know, the trade-offs between public health and surveillance, and how, if we're going to develop strategies, we really have to allow ordinary people to be part of the conversation.
I want to focus on one interesting aspect of your book, especially during this time of the coronavirus, when people are, in some states at least, still are being asked to stay at home because it's safer. We are often isolated and are aching for human connection. And these days, more people meet potential romantic partners on their phones through dating apps. And this is an interesting thing that you take on in your book. There are, of course, dating apps that enable people to meet one another. But of course, the phones can also turn into these insidious tools of, that can be used by sexual predators. So how does smartphone technology affect these kinds of connections with one another that can either be very positive or extremely negative?
Well, as you say, it can be both things, right? I think one of the best ways to think about technology is not to kind of put technology, whether it's our smartphone or any kind of technological advancements in the past, right? Television, radio, the automobile, rather than putting these particular technologies in the driver's seat, right, as the kind of driving force of social change, I think it's more useful to view technology as emblematic or illustrative of broader sort of social relationships and power dynamics. So if we're thinking about the relationships between men and women and the potential for abuse, sexism, or on the flip side, the empowering capacities of technology for women to, achieve autonomy, achieve agency. I think we can see both dynamics. And certainly we see some frightening trends of, even more than sexual predators, we see domestic abusers who are easily and readily taking up smartphone technology and apps and using these things to control their partners and abuse their partners. This is a very much more overwhelming trend than sort of random strangers using smartphones to hurt women. But on the flip side, I think there really is there are a lot of interesting dynamics of people meeting, particularly in this strange time. I've read some fascinating accounts of, because younger people who are, you know, on the dating scene are not able to actually see each other in person, they're connecting through their smartphones and having much more kind of old-fashioned dates, where perhaps they play a board game together or have a conversation about the things that are happening in their neighborhood, and sex is not on the table for obvious reasons. So I think that there are, you know, if we're thinking about technology and relationships, we have to see technology as sort of obviously not having, it's not that technology has no impact. Of course it does, right? Otherwise we wouldn't be studying it, but rather to see it as a window into these kind of broader social dynamics.
So are we asking the wrong question when we say, is technology good or bad?
Well, when we ask that question, it's a deep question. We're asking it because we feel uncomfortable with the way that technology is being used. And I think if we specify our question, right? Rather than saying, is technology causing this bad thing? But rather to say, how is technology being used in ways that perhaps disempower people, increase mental illness, create jobs that are precarious or exploitative? If we keep people in the equation, then we can ask very precise and I think valuable questions about how technology is being used, whether it's in the types of new work relationships we're developing, the types of new romantic partnerships, and so on.
So let's talk about an issue that is very much in the news, has been for several years now, and that is how misinformation spreads in our society. There's a time, of course, when most people would get their information from news programs that they'd listen to on the radio or network television or even cable news shows. These days, you get it from apps on your phone like Facebook and Twitter, and you share, or you might quickly watch a short video snippet and share it. And it's easy to fall for fake news. I have older relatives who'll forward bizarre stories to me, about the person who really was found to have killed Princess Diana, and not realize that this is a pretty easy to spot piece of fake news, because they got it forwarded from someone they trust, and so they're passing it on. So it seems as though the issue of information, this information age we're in, is almost equally a misinformation age.
Yeah, and this is, of course, a very complex question, and people have written entire books about just this question. I think when we're thinking about a topic or a problem such as fake news and where people are getting information and their, the susceptibility, particularly of new technology users, to misinformation, this should encourage us to think about first, where are people getting information? Say people are getting a lot of their news from Facebook. Well, what kind of a company is Facebook? And what does it provide, right? And how does it make its revenue, right? If we think about the fact that Facebook makes all of its money from advertisers, right? By selling data and access to data, which is access to users, to advertisers. So we think, well, in the old days, right, just 20 years ago, advertisers spent money on newspapers, right? So they put their ads in newspapers and magazines and television programs. Well, now this ad money is going to platforms like Facebook. So Facebook is very interested in keeping people on its platform, right, to generate data and to be able to make those advertising dollars. Well, this is a huge shift, not only because it undermined the traditional journalism model, but because it's corralling people into this new platform where they're getting content. Some of that content is quality news, and some of it is fake news. And, Facebook had said, well, it's not, we're not a media company, right? People should know that. Well, it's more complicated. And this is why I think there has to be a much harder hitting and broader conversation about the value of news, right, as a central part of democracy, and how we can't allow it to be sort of passively controlled, whether it's by a social media platform or some other type of small apps, but to say it's part of society, and we really have to actually support it.
So going back to what you were saying earlier, and also what you were just intimating, these massive technological companies that have reaped so much money, obscene levels of money, from the fact that we are all using smartphone technology, have this extremely unequal relationship with us. There's been a lot of talk about doing things like nationalizing Facebook, etc. Where do you stand on how we can make the relationship more equal? I mean, at the very least, these are companies that ought to be facing far more robust regulations.
Absolutely. I agree. If we think about how essential a company like Google or even a company like Facebook has become to our modern way of life, it's almost as important as our ability to turn on the water and turn on the lights. It's difficult to imagine doing work doing research, connecting with each other, getting information without these tech companies, right? They basically have created a utility. But this is, it's not a public utility, right? It's not democratically controlled. And many of the, norms and behaviors exhibited by these companies are norms and behaviors that are being self-regulated by the companies themselves. And often they'll make small changes in response to public criticism, but there hasn't been a large concerted push, particularly in the United States, to really take stock of this kind of emergent ecosystem of technology companies and this, very powerful new relationship that people have with digital devices. So I absolutely agree with you. I think we really need to develop a new type of relationship, and with it, regulations that really, but these are things that should be democratically decided, right? It's not for one or two people to say, well, this is what needs to be done.
I think it should be a public conversation. You have Twitter's Jack Dorsey and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg making decisions about, well, this documentary or this piece of fake news and misinformation is not going to be allowed on our platform. But then they are making exceptions for, say, the President of the United States. When Trump touts conspiracy theories that are dangerous or makes dangerous suggestions that literally affect people's lives, they make exceptions for him because he's the president, but then apply a higher standard to others. Those are choices that these companies are making because no one else is making the choice for them.
Absolutely. And they're extremely far-reaching choices, right? They impact literally billions of people. So questions about free speech are not easy to answer, but they're questions that need to be decided in a democratic sphere, not by a few corporate executives.
So finally, Nicole, how do you see the bright side when it comes to progressive values and even organizing to our smartphone technology? Because as you said, these are tools for us, and people have really used these in some constructive ways, not necessarily because Google and Facebook have helped, but they've used those technologies to further democratic engagement, participation, and understanding. Presidential candidates have used them to raise money and to raise awareness. People have used them, thinking about, say, protests in Hong Kong, have used them to outsmart the police, if you will. Should people who consider themselves responsible citizens and use these smartphones as best as they can to further democracy?
Absolutely. This is not an anti-technology book, and I own a smartphone. Though I really do see smartphones as a tool, but a tool that we should demand control over, right? Not a tool that we allow to have control over us. And I think this is an important distinction. If we look at all of the amazing things, particularly in the sphere of politics, that people are using their smartphones for, this is exciting. And also, I think there's a broader, particularly in the past few years, there's a broader conversation that's starting to happen about people's desire to have control over technology and to really kind of rein in big technology companies. So I'm hopeful that people will, take control of the, that tiny pocket computer. But it will require a strong push. Companies like Google and Facebook spend millions of dollars lobbying to preserve their interests and to preserve the terrain that they currently control. So it's going to be a push, but I'm confident that we can make some real headway.
Well, Nicole, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and wish you the best of luck with your new book.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Nicole Ashoff, editor-at-large of Jacobin magazine, where she writes about capitalism, technology, and labor. Her earlier book was The New Profits of Capital. We've been discussing her latest book called The Smartphone Society, Technology, Power, and Resistance in the New Gilded Age. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.